So, hey everybody, how's it going? Good, good. Welcome. We are talking about scaling today. One of the things I want to tell you is that Matt couldn't make it today. We crossed him off, but hopefully he'll come in and we'll uncross him. But one of the things I had a problem with very early on with scaling was I didn't know who to turn to or who to really ask for advice. So that mic is going to be open the entire time. So if you want to come up and you have questions, we've got a great crew here to answer those questions, and highly recommend you take advantage of that. So let's go down the line and do introductions. My name's Kevin Rose. I'm the founder of Dig, and I really don't need to say much more than that. I'll go with these guys.
My name's Garrett Camp, founder of StumbleUpon, and
okay. I'm Chris.
Hello.
Is this working? Okay. Is that loud enough? No? Okay, we're good. I work for Media Temple. We're a web hosting company in Los Angeles.
My name's Joe Stump. I'm currently the lead architect for Dig.com.
And I'm Cal Henderson. I work for Flickr, the kitten sharing website.
Cool. So I guess we can kick it off with my first question was, when do people need to worry about scaling? With Dig very early on, we didn't worry for the first 6 months. And looking back on things, that was a big mistake. And we ran into a lot of problems. We had servers going up and down, and there were issues that we didn't know how to solve. And I guess a lot of the questions I always get at various different panels are, people have a blog or they're building a web app for the first time, but they don't know when they need to start thinking about this. I mean, is this something that they need to think about on day one? Is there certain things that we can do ahead of time? What are your guys' thoughts?
I think it really depends on your app. If you're starting out a site, for instance, that's like YouTube or Flickr, you need to instantly consider your storage solutions and how you're going to scale out when your site becomes big and all of a sudden you need to host 1 million videos or a couple billion photos, et cetera, like that. So it really depends on your application. If it's just a content site, blog, and you're delivering text, it's something that you can kind of defer for a bit.
Sorry, Matt, we had crossed you off, but I will uncross you now.
I appreciate it.
Damn it, Doc. Come with me.
Yep. We're totally the people you should trust about technical issues, by the way.
Get a PC.
Every time I see someone struggle, it's supposed to be next.
All right. There we go. Yay!
How's it going, Matt?
Awesome.
Doing all right?
All right. So go ahead, Joe. Sorry.
So I was just saying that basically it depends on the kind of application that you're building. Some applications you need to start considering that immediately, especially if you're basically rebranding and reselling storage. At the end of the day, Yahoo, Flickr, Pounce, et cetera, you know, storage is kind of a key component to their architecture and what they do. So scaling that out was, I'm sure, a consideration they took on very, very early on, whereas in a blog, you don't really need to worry about that so much at the beginning. You really just need to worry about reacting to getting dug or getting slash dotted or whatever. And that's pretty easy to fix with caching.
Yeah, so I kind of have the...
I want to argue with Joe. So I'm trying to think up an argument. I think early on, like at least the first year of Flickr, we didn't know what we were doing at all. But we didn't really care about scaling because the most important thing then was kind of pace of development, of doing interesting stuff and kind of breaking new ground. And if we'd taken time out to worry about scaling in the future and what the fuck we were doing, then I don't think we would have had that same pace. And I think it's important. It kind of depends, very much depends on the space in which you're in. I mean, if you are ultimately a reseller of space, you know, like disk space or storage or something like that, then you need to think about that stuff early on. But for most people, a lot of people can ignore scale forever, depending on the numbers they're going to get to. I mean, I would rather not worry about it ever again.
I would rather not worry about it as well. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case. One of the things that I don't particularly like about Web 2.0 is everybody out there, you want me to store your data, and you want it to be accessible, and you want it to be fast, and you want to have it all the time. And as an engineer, I hate that. I can't ever sunset anything. Like, Cal can't say, well, nobody's looked at this photo in 4 years, so I'm just going to go ahead and delete it. Because at 4 years and 10 days in, somebody's going to go and try and look at it and be, you know, livid.
Can't we just use S3? Isn't that what that's for?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So when was the first time you guys ran into some serious issues? And I mean, and what did you do? Was it turning to books? I mean, where did you get your help, and how did you tackle those?
I think kind of, so Flickr's a little bit old now. We're having our fourth birthday party in San Francisco. I think next week. You should all fucking come. it's on the internet. We're pretty old now, so a lot of the kind of Web 2.0 mainstays today weren't around when we started having issues, which I guess would be about 3 years ago now, maybe 2.5. And so really the only people to turn to, the only kind of interesting resource at the time was all of the work that Brad had put out there for LiveJournal. Mm-hmm. So the kind of talks that he'd done in the last couple of years, the OSCON talks, and he put together a really good PDF. The name now escapes me, but you can find it on his personal website. And so I think LiveJournal were really the site that we looked to as the first in the space who had talked about how they were doing stuff. Because obviously people have been doing big stuff on the internet for a long time, especially the Yahoos and the Googles and the what have yous. But they never really talk about how they do these things. And they usually do these things with a lot of engineers and a lot of time and a lot of money. And we didn't have any of those.
Yeah, I would say too, currently, if you guys haven't read Cal's book, I'll pitch it for you. He wrote a book on some of the stuff that he had to go through building Flickr, and it's just excellent. A lot of times when people are like, yeah, you know, we're building this thing and it needs to scale out, and you know, I'm at a conference and they want to talk to me, and I sort of look at them and go, okay, have you read Cal's book? And they go, no. And I'm like, okay, well, go read Cal's book and then come back and we'll talk. So there's a lot of good stuff in there if you're looking to really build something that you think is going to be big. You know, I think it is important now, you know, with the digs and so on, they can throw so much traffic around. You kind of have to start, if you can, early and think, okay, how big could this really get? And, of course, you don't really know, but it's better to, you know, make an educated guess. And if you're wrong, you're wrong, but it's better than not making an educated guess.
Hmm. Yeah. And as long as you have a plan in place, I mean, you don't necessarily need to do a lot of these things right from the beginning, but as long as you kind of know what the first pain points will be and kind of have a plan in place, at least when it happens, you'll kind of know what to do. Because we got to a beginning, we were in a situation where, you know, something would break and we didn't even know what was wrong. Yeah, so if we would have kind of like put just a little bit of time, even 10% of the time into the kind of scaling planning, then what would have happened, I think we would have been able to recover in like a day instead of, you know, 2 days or 3 days. So yeah.
The thing that helped us a lot early on was not just the LiveJournal stuff, which actually is directly applicable because they're hosting essentially blogs, but the Wikimedia Foundation has posted, well, A, they're 100% open source stack, so there's no NetScalers, there's no NetApps, there's nothing proprietary in there. It's 100% commodity hardware and open source stuff, and they publish everything. I mean, they publish their MySQL config files and everything like that, so it's really nice to sort of dig in there and see what they've done with different things and the approaches they've taken.
So you mentioned NetScaler. These are crazy expensive boxes. We've bought a couple of them at Dig. Do you think that at some point you need to turn to a kind of more enterprise solution for scaling your website, or can you go completely open source?
No.
NetScaler is an appliance for removing money from small companies.
Yeah, I've scaled quite a few places out using completely commodity hardware. In fact, I can't even tell you where I bought it. I think some of them I even built myself. Instead of NetScaler, one of the products that I've used with great success is Linux Virtual Server. Mm-hmm. It's great for balancing TCP and UDP traffic. We used to put that both in front of our web servers at a place called Enotes.com and in front of our DB slaves as well, which is really good because then you can do self-monitoring of the DB slaves so that, you know, it's constantly polling and saying, are you behind the master, and what's your load, and, you know, and all those kinds of stats. And if it sees anything as kind of getting out of whack, it'll automatically drop it from the pool and whatnot. So I think if you're just getting in and you need to balance TCP traffic, I don't know if anything else other than Squid.
Well, I mean, LVS is really awesome, and LVS plus HA proxy allows you to do layer 7 balancing really cheaply if you're into that kind of thing. I mean, for kind of out-of-the-box ease, PearlBal is probably way easier to set up than LVS, and you can just slap it on your web servers and do round-robin DNS, really kind of cheap man-load balancing.
Yeah, yep. I mean, we got really bitten in the ass by, we bought some very expensive Foundry gear for load balancing, so, you know, enterprise, you know, commodity, you know, like, super expensive load balancing, just going to work, and basically, they lied about what the things could do, and they had said, you know, you can put X gazillion IPs on them, and it's fine. And actually, that was some theoretical limit, and practically, you could put like 1/100th of that on before they started getting cranky, and they did. And in fairness, Foundry totally owned up and they took them back and they were very cool about it. We've swapped it out for LVS boxes since then and they work great. But I think a good point to put in with the open sourceness of it is, I mean, regardless of how big you might one day go, I mean, you can go a long way with commodity hardware and open source stuff. I mean, possibly as far as you're ever going to need to go, but certainly, a couple of years in, you're probably going to be fine using commodity hardware and open source technologies like that.
Yeah, I mean, we only rented 3 boxes up until the third year, I think. So we had like maybe 500,000 registered users on kind of 2 database boxes and 1 front end. So, I mean, you don't really have to be too concerned about the stuff that we're getting. Like, just focus on kind of getting the product right, and then, you'll know fairly soon when it's time to get you're going to have a lot of boxes before you need a NetScaler.
To be devil's advocate and disagree with everybody, there are reasons to go with the hardware load balancing appliances, but they're fairly tenuous. Firstly, I mean, it's just slightly easier. You can just go out and buy something. So if you have a huge amount of money to burn, it's slightly easier
like
than setting
you
up yourself.
Like if you're owned by Yahoo?
I think it's even harder. You think it's harder?
Yeah, because it's so hard to buy things. You know, when someone says enterprise, it means they don't put their prices on the website. It means you have to, talk to someone with slick back hair for 30 minutes, and it's just uncomfortable all
That's
around.
That's true.
But I haven't yet found the limits of the open source stack.
So, a couple of the limits. One is, so to talk about that, I think there's two main reasons, apart from perhaps the ease issue. One is that if you want to do logging at the load balancer level, because you're getting a lot of traffic and you, for some reason, you can't aggregate your logs across the servers that it's balancing because you have too much data, then often load balancer will be able to stream logs in a useful format, which you can then analyze. So if you have trouble dealing with your volume of log data, software load balancers tend to do a really bad job of that. I don't know any that do a really good job of it. And secondly, if you're doing an insane amount of traffic, it's difficult to configure LVS to do more than 10 gigabits, for instance.
So like if you're serving tons of images?
For instance, if you were serving a ton of images, yeah.
We found we use Pound for our HTTP load balancing. It's another open source, layer 7 load balancer. It's fantastic. It's also super easy to get going. Even I was able to do it. And we haven't yet reached the limits. It also streams the log formats really nicely.
Oh, Pound, yeah. Pound's kind of awesome. I mean, it's very limited in what it does, but what it does very, very well.
Well, the other thing we found is that, not being a hardware thing, we were able to go in and modify it where we needed to. Like, we needed a more static hashing algorithm for the, place it was sending the request, and we were able to do that with, a 4-line patch.
Oh, nice.
Lately, we've been starting to use Nginx, which is this awesome thing. If you speak Russian, it's even better, because that's why that all documentation is in. But it's spelled Nginix and pronounced Nginx, and it's kind of blown away Pound so far, but we just haven't switched yet because we're still working on it.
So I'm curious, how many people out here are building their own web app? Raise of hands. Wow. How many people are on like a rented server? Just curious. See, this is cool. So, question.
What about Amazon?
Yeah, how many people on Amazon web services or S3, any of that stuff?
A little less.
Yeah, a little less. So this question is kind of a little bit for Chris. I've seen on your site and other sites, especially that provide the rented hardware, they say unlimited, or we can scale you, or what do they call? What does Media Temple call their
clustered service?
Yeah, right. So at what point does that break down, and when do these people need to worry about that?
Okay, it's a long answer. I'm going to try and not make it a long answer. Our grid service is essentially it's a clustered system. So you put your stuff up, and we take care of sort of load balancing for you. And the idea is that we have more hardware available than any one customer is likely to use. If they're in a point where they're going to be paying like $20 a month, certainly more than you're likely to use. Having said that, we certainly get, and we'll talk about this a little more later, but we get customers that have developed something badly. Not on purpose, they just did something, bad. And if you do something significant, sufficiently bad in your code or in your database or whatever, and you get a sufficient amount of traffic from like Dig, pretty much no amount of hardware, will save you, depending on how bad whatever the bad thing was. So in terms of when you start doing that, it's definitely a great way to get started. We a lot of companies have gotten their products started on our grid service. I would say that something like our grid service, one of its big things is that it's managed, so you don't have like root on the box, and we provide a lot of tools for you, and we're always working on new ones that we get requests for. But we present an environment to you, and that's it. That's what you get. So that's kind of where the hard line would be, is when you need to develop something or configure something or make your server do something that is specialized to your application. Because, you know, if it's something that just you need and we've got 20,000 customers on this platform, you know, unless we can do it easily and without affecting the other, you know, 19,000 or whatever, we're not going to do it. You know, that's when you would want to get more dedicated hardware that you have more control over.
I think the key right there to Chris's point is that when scalability equals specialization. If you think you're going to scale a generalized solution to, say, 11,000 requests a second, you are pretty much wrong. And that's a problem that I have when people come up to me and they say, oh, I have this problem and I need to know how to scale. And I tell them, okay, well, what works for me may not work for you, but I can tell you how I scaled. And what's worked for, I've worked for three companies that have done 15 million plus page views a month where you need to start specializing at that point. And all three of their architectures was different in many, many different ways. Cal's architecture is a lot different because he focuses on storage. Our architecture is a lot different because we have many, 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 many writes going on. Think about how quickly you go down that page and click dig, 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 and bury, bury, et cetera. So, you know, our architecture focuses on being able to scale a lot of DB writes. You know, Cal's is focused on storage, and you know,
we do some DB writes as well.
A few, I assume. Yeah,
we're like 11% writes, I think, or something.
11% writes. Huh? Yeah. Do you know your percentage?
About 50%.
About 50% writes. Wow, wow, that's amazing.
Tax. Well, because we read from cache, we don't read from the database.
Oh.
So if you want to ask questions, please just come up right here and line up at any time, by the way.
It's good to start on like the cheapest stuff possible. In fact, our dev servers are still like 2 years older than our web servers, simply because I like the developers being on slower boxes.
Our dev servers are a pile of crap. Actually, we moved one of our main dev servers to a slightly faster machine. It made us so much more efficient.
Well, I think one of the best things for us early on was we had these servers that were underpowered. One of them went down every 10 minutes, you know, and so we were able to build in things like failover very early on in the application because we were forced to. And
EC2 seems to be really awesome for kind of a development environment where you can just spin up a whole bunch of hosts. I would really, if you think you're going to have to build something at scale that's going to, at least span more than a couple of web servers, more than a couple of database servers, spin up some EC2 instances and then test what happens when you turn them off. Because it's far easier than buying 10 boxes to test within dev environment.
Or run Zen yourself anymore. Like, it's just ridiculous. The economics are not in your favor anymore. I mean,
somewhat depends on the scale you're at.
Well, I think, we still rent 100% of our boxes, and there's now a ton. And the thing is that the economics of scale that like a LayerTech or a ServerBeach has when they have 15, 16, 20,000 servers is different from what we're going to have. Even at 1,000 servers, you know, and they get bandwidth cheaper, they get hardware cheaper, they get everything. And we've done the pricing, you know, how much would it cost us, the colo boxes, to buy them, to do the network, and to have someone there 24 hours a day to deal with that. And we just can't get, it doesn't even compare. It's like twice as much.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, nowadays we're managed by Yahoo. But in the early days, we bought our own boxes, the cheapest possible hardware we could buy, and then just rented colo space. So we had, you know, NOC support from the colo we happened to be in, and that was cheapest at the time. But I guess that was a while ago now, so stuff's changed.
I think it's shifted, where now you basically have what's essentially hardware as a service. And I like it actually better than Amazon, because with Amazon, you're sort of tied into the way they spin up boxes and the way that works. And it's actually kind of expensive if you keep a box on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It works out to what you could get a root on a dedicated server for at one of these places, you know, like 80, 90 bucks a month. And it's just, and that's more portable, because Amazon's not a true utility because it has no competitors, right? I can't change the host name in my Amazon API stuff and go to a different provider. There's no one else that duplicates their APIs yet. But I can totally, you know, get root on another box and log in and you're fine.
It's true. But, I mean, you can also do the Amazon-like stuff yourself and just run Zen instances. I know a couple of people who are doing that at scale now. They buy or rent all their own hardware and run Zen instances on top, which makes porting stuff between machines much easier.
Yeah.
Question?
I want you to talk a little bit more about some of the scalability of open source stuff, specifically around database stuff. So we right now have about a terabyte worth of database stuff. That's about 50% hits on it, right? We split it across 7 MySQL databases. We can't do slaves because they don't help us very much because of that high writing ability for it. MySQL cluster's not quite there yet. They're just starting to get some of the abilities out there. And I'm wondering what your guys' feedback is on, as we continue to grow and scale that type of thing, the wider we go, the more challenging the application is to split amongst all these different MySQL servers. But we're hitting the limits of the depth we can go to. We're at, you know, 4 processor boxes at least right now, and, you know, as much RAM as we can spit on there. So, like, what's our next step? Because I used to work in Oracle, and we know what the next step in Oracle is. It's buying Oracle, it's buying a bunch of licenses, and, you know, just using money. What's the next step in the open source?
Are you partitioning your data?
Yeah, yeah. We're partitioning data inside the databases, too, but we partitioned it across 7 MySQL instances, so it's a separate partition per machine, too, essentially.
So, I mean, one of your assumptions there is that you want to go open source. I mean, the easiest way to solve scaling problems is by throwing money at them. It's like engineering time. When you're a very early startup and you don't pay your employees, then hardware's really expensive and engineering's cheap. But, I mean, after that point, engineering is expensive. If you can just go out there and pay for Oracle rack licenses and it solves your problems, that's so much easier than actually doing any software engineering.
Right. Yeah. we can't do that, though, right? Because, we would spend $500,000 right now
to transition. So you've already sharded your database. I mean, what's preventing you from sharding it more?
At this point, pretty much developer and maintenance time. I mean, the more MySQL databases you have, the more one pings and crashes out periodically, and you got to deal with slaves and stuff, and it's just maintenance time at that point.
It's definitely, you know, slaves are not just for performance, it also can be for reliability, where it makes it super easy to fail
over.
We've
got all 7 instances slaved twice for backups and a couple other things, too. So I'm just wondering, at that point, like what's some of your guys' options for?
Well, one of the things that we're doing at Dig right now, we're actually working on partitioning our database as well, and we have a centralized, what I call like an IDDB. You have this central DB that tells you where each numeric ID is amongst all of your partitions. And we've taken what I call the spray and pray approach to this kind of thing, where we basically say this is a user record and all of their user data, and we want to put that on 3 different partitions. And then what happens then is when I go to the IDDB and say, hey, where's this user ID? It returns back 3 different servers, and then I randomly grab one of those. So what I do at the end of the day, like if I need to bring one of those down for maintenance or one of them just fails, I go into the partition record, the partition table, and say, this partition's completely down. And then I have 2 other partitions that I can still go get that user's data from.
We do a very similar thing, similar-ish, in which each of our partitions is multiple machines, which we all write to all of the time and all stay in sync all of the time. So we can just pull a machine out of that, or machines can die. For kind of very easy, just use master-master replication on a pair of machines with MySQL. For more complicated, you're going to have to get into proprietary replication because of the MySQL single master limit. But that's how we do it at Flickr. We just have an awful lot of different, a huge number of different partitions. And we just keep spreading stuff out as we need to add more capacity.
Now, did you say that the reason you're not just going to shard more is that it's, the developer time is significant and that's going to make it?
Yeah, we have 1.5 times this admin and 3 developers, you know, so it's not quite managing.
Right. So I haven't, I'm just starting to play around with it yet, but there's a MySQL proxy project, which is exactly what it sounds like. But one of the things it does is it embeds the Lua language. So you can send it whatever you want, and then you can use Lua to, you know, have whatever logic you need. So you could have, you know, as much sharding as you want. You could have, you know, 80 gazillion databases out there. And as far as your application is concerned, you just talk to the proxy, and the proxy knows what to do. Mm-hmm. Because I'm just starting to mess around with it. It looks really cool. I don't know how it's going to hold up under crazy traffic and crazy loads, but it's worth looking at.
My blog log uses MySQL proxy, and one of the things you can do with it, like that Chris was kind of alluded to, is you can actually, in Lua, you can parse certain things out. So you could actually say, like, prepend your query with user ID equals 57 colon, and then the actual query string, and it will, you know, it'll say, oh, well, this begins with this, and then parses that out, and it knows where to go and get it and whatnot. So it's just called MySQL proxy, and it uses the Lua language.
Lua is just a scripting language.
Yeah, Lua is, yeah. Just,
it's a good open source name. We ran into the same problems, and we ended up open sourcing our database class. We solved this all in the application lever, and we didn't find anything that really worked for it. So if you Google for HyperDB, that's our open source database class, and deals with failover, multi-data surrender replication, masters, slaves, lots of config stuff. So.
Go for it. I know one of the things you guys were just talking about is the cost of developer time, and we're talking about scaling servers, but what about scaling people and teams? You know, I know some of you guys are running an office. Matt, I think you guys are all remote. And it brings all kinds of different issues from efficiency. When you bring somebody new who's clueless, you're going to have to take somebody who's good to spend time to help them get up to speed versus cultural issues of remote teams, of just making sure communication's happening. I was wondering, what are some of the issues that you addressed as you were scaling for teams, and how were some of the solutions that really worked well?
Sure. So we've been kind of exploding in the development department at DIG. We've gone from 3 to 7 to 10. We'll be at 15 probably by the end of this month. And one of the things that I found out, I know developers hate this, but adding a bit more structure. We had a problem early on where there was kind of too many chefs in the kitchen. So we needed to basically add a little bit more structure and somebody to be, you know, like pound the gavel and make those final decisions. Because when you have two developers, it's really easy to develop consensus. You know, when you have one developer, it's super easy because it's just you. And then when you get to 7, there's always one descending, you know, there's always one person that's like, I don't like this, you know. So you get all 7 people in the room, and you're like, okay, well, let's do paracoding standards, for instance, for PHP or something. And someone's like, well, I hate putting, you know, underscores in my names. And you're always going to have that one holdout. So the one thing I would say is definitely add structure, appoint someone that is the grand poobah, and then as you keep going out, I found out in my experience, I don't know about everybody else's, but it seems to be the perfect team size for me is between 3 and 6 developers. Because between 3 and 6, you can still develop mostly consensus and then have one lead on that team as well. So what we're getting ready to do probably at DIG soon is we'll have, you know, like one team that just does back-end stuff, one team that does product, one team that does partner integration and stuff. So as you scale out, that's really important. We use Track, which has been totally awesome.
Track's really good.
Track's awesome.
Yeah, if you're not using Track, I highly recommend it, especially if you use SVN. We've done some things with Track where you can't do check-ins unless you actually own the ticket. You have to reference the ticket, other stuff. We do lint checking on check-in and stuff like that. So Track's really, really, really great, and so is SVN for kind of keeping... I'm kind of a code Nazi, so I really like to make sure that, you know, what people are checking in is appropriate. So it has an XML feed. So as I have my leads and my seniors just follow that the change set, and we literally on the fly review almost every change set that goes into Trunk. So.
One thing that we found too, and when I say we found, I mean we're bad at and trying to improve. And it sounds so simple, but just, you know, spending the extra time, and, you know, everyone's going to spend an extra 2 hours a week doing this, but, you know, just really documenting your code well. Because one of the tricks you find, of course, is that, you know, your project gets bigger, your application's bigger, you know, your code base is not, you know, 15 files like it used to be. It's, you know, an ass load of code. And you hire somebody new, and, you know, they've got to get up to speed. So that takes them a lot of time. And if there's not good documentation, it takes everyone else a lot of time, too, because they've got to be answering questions. So you want to minimize that. And the only way to do
Brooks
that
Law.
Is... Yeah. Yeah.
And we design all our software in the wiki before we even start to implement it. So we try now to basically have everything like written out, all the kind of thoughts and what we wanted it to do and what like the inputs and outputs are in the wiki before we even start developing. And it's actually pretty good because new people, when they come aboard, can just read the wiki instead of having to... You know, do it.
Yeah, it's nice.
And as long as you, and also it's really important to kind of cross training, like have two people who learned at the same time, because I mean, I sort of think a lot about redundancy in terms of hardware, but redundancy in terms of people. I mean, we have someone who goes on vacation and, you know, got to make sure that if they're gone and they're, you know, not available by cell phone 24/7, they're not going to be able to, you know, someone else could fix it. So
kind of a cliche, where, you know, like a lot of people, a lot of developers that are like, oh, I'm hardcore, they're anti extreme programming and anti Scrum and anti agile. And really, alluding to, you know, Garrett's like redundancy in people, you definitely want to have two people that own every major system in your entire code structure. So you want two people, like I want two people coding at the same time. I want two people, you know, going over the architecture and what they're going to be putting into the code, two people documenting. Because, you know, if Steve Williams flies under the bus one time, like as he's riding his bike from Caltrain, we're screwed on our API because he wrote the whole API. You know, Kurt's done a little bit of work on it, but what happens then? You know, you have a problem. So that's why you always want to do, you know, Agile, Scrum, XP. Like, you know, for the longest time, the hardcore developers I knew, they were like, oh, that's just academics, and it's not. It really, as you scale your team out, you really need to be doing that.
XP works really well. I mean, we did XP for the first 4 years, it was nothing but, like, everything that was written was two people looking at the same code, and you kind of caught each other's mistakes. And I think it went a lot slower, but in the end, it was a lot less rewriting, a lot less re-architecting.
So I have a question for Joe. What is this documentation thing you're talking about?
The document.
Seriously, I think the people to the left of me are way more disciplined than I am, or than our team is. I mean, the two ways to shortcut both of these issues are on the decision issue. Hire people who generally agree with you. That makes it a lot easier. and as for the kind of junior engineer issue, you could just hire really smart people. That's kind of what we do, but that's cheating, I realize.
No, it's not, because it's reducing the problem set. And sometimes it's a business decision, right? Like, sometimes it's right to do less features. When you look at some of these teams that have, like, 30 different, features that they have to finish by next week, of course it's going to be crappy and unscalable. But I would say we do the opposite of everything that's been said before Cal. And it works mostly, but when you have the right people.
I mean, you have the advantage that you hire people, but you have a lot of people who just care a lot about your code anyway, and so learn it first. And I guess when you're hiring people to work on proprietary products, that's not really the same thing.
Well, open source is great because people who work together in a virtual manner and build consensus online, and there's never two people in the same place. I mean, you sort of develop these things, and you develop a set of processes that applies really well to internal code as well as external code.
So one question for you guys. How do you feel about remote workers? I know at Dig very early on in the first few months, we ran into some serious issues where the site was falling over, and we didn't care where they were. We actually hired someone back east to work and help scale the site. Do you have anybody that works remotely, or is it all in-house?
We don't have any technical team that work remotely. We do, however, basically everyone in engineering and development is basically supposed to take one day off-site a week, and often we do take more. A lot of it is, it's a question of who you hire. If you hire the right people and they're motivated and they work hard, then that really works well. Because, when you're in the office, especially at Media Temple, we're very interrupt-driven. You know, there's customer support issues and, that thing's crashing. We have to stop working what we're doing and go fix it and whatever. So there's a lot of interrupt in the office. Also, the flip side is you're in the office and you can talk to people and they're right there. So we sort of break it up that way. We haven't hired anyone that works entirely remote, but we all work remote some of the time, and those are, in terms of coding, our most productive days, because you just sit there in your boxers, with the shades drawn, and you hack out code, and there's a lot less people bothering you. And that's worked out pretty well for us.
On the other hand, to kind of play devil's advocate again, definitely, I mean, we have a bunch of remote engineers, and they're more productive, not necessarily in the writing code sense, but just the getting stuff done and working on projects when they're in the office. I mean, if you have engineers who are really good, then it's fine if they work remote, if they're still producing good stuff, but there's definite benefit to just bringing everybody together now and again. So all of our remote workers, we try and bring them into the office, like for a week a month or a week every couple of months to kind of work together on stuff and sync up. I find that really helps.
We're 100% remote. Like in terms of talking to people, I might not even do it for a couple of months. We get together twice a year, which is good, but more for a social thing rather than a work thing.
Yeah, well, I think it's a lot about social as well, just so that all of your team can get on.
I would say the downsides, now that we're 100% remote, it's not a work thing as much as I think the social aspects are different. People start to feel a little more isolated. They don't have water cooler chats. So you lose a little bit of that. The model that we're probably going to be moving to over time, well, right now we're 100% remote, every man is an island. We're probably going to start clustering people, like maybe two people in Austin, two people in Vancouver, so they can get together once a week, hang out, grab some drinks. And if a meteor hits, I never thought about that.
Hi. You all work on pretty different applications. I'm just curious where you found bottlenecks and how they were different depending on different applications. And anything people should be aware of?
To quote Sarah Goldman, your bottleneck will never, ever, ever be in your language. So all you language zealots out there, quit it, please. It doesn't have anything to do with PHP.
Unless you're using Ruby.
Gauntlet! But
when you look at your bottlenecks, I guarantee it will never, ever be whether you're using double quotes or single quotes or whether you chose Perl or PHP. It's never that. It's always your DB, always. And if it's not your DB, it's your file storage, which means if you're like storing on NFS, you need to move to Mogile. If you're storing on Mogile and for some reason that's not working, maybe S3 will. But I've always found in every single instance when I've had bottlenecks, it's been my DB first and foremost, and it's been file storage and file access or disk I/O, basically.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's nearly always I/O related. So it's either file storage or it's database, but it's I/O. I mean, the first obvious pain point for Flickr, which is kind of obvious in retrospect if you're storing a whole bunch of photos, is that we ran out of disk space. but with a tiny
did you see that one coming?
With a tiny bit of foresight, you could avoid that. So, like, there's under, I don't know if any of you guys know, but under Linux, df will tell you how much space you have left.
I've heard that.
Yeah, we see, for us, it's a little bit different because, you know, we're a hosting company, so it's, you know, our job isn't to create an application, it's to create a platform so that our customers can create applications. So it's sort of a different ballgame. But yeah, internally, what we find is that we're fighting disk I/O. That's our big one. And our customers fight their databases.
For us, it's all, again, the size of the database. And one thing we like to look at is the rate of change of each table, just to kind of anticipate when we're going to have to partition. And right now, for us, Stumbles is like, I think over half of our data is just recording that someone has seen a site so we don't show them a duplicate. So, I mean, that's a pretty custom kind of case, and that's like half our data. So we have like six boxes, I guess, dedicated just to making sure that people don't see the same site again. So, I mean, every application will be very different. Just you have to look at your data set and analyze it.
We scaled out the wrong things early on. So I thought that we were going to be write bound, like how are some of the people on, and we weren't. But I partitioned things into 4,096 databases before we got started. So that was a little extreme. And what ended up causing the bottleneck being later is that it wasn't the blogs that get, you know, millions and millions of hits a day, the cheeseburgers of the world. Those are easy with caching. It's the, you know, 2.5 million blogs that get 10 hits a day. So they're hitting lots of unused, uncached parts of the database. And the way that our structure is that they're often hitting cold tables. So they got to fire up the tables, put the table in the cache, all of that. And that was pretty tough.
Yeah, I would say one of the things that I've found at Dig, too, is that a lot of people think when they look at their database, they say, I need to make sure all of this will scale. You know, we have something like 200 tables at Dig, and I think two of them are problem children. The rest of them, like, don't matter, and they're not a problem. One of them is comment digs. I think there's over 1 billion comment digs and berries and 200 million digs, I think. Is that right, Kevin? 200 million?
It's 250, something like that.
Yeah, so those are our two problem children. Like, the rest of them, like, it doesn't matter. Like, that's not a big deal. Those are our two highest write tables, and they're also our two highest read tables because we have to read all that back out to make sure, you know, that we gray out comments that you've buried and stuff like that. So one thing when you're looking to scale out your database, if you have 10 or 15 or 20 tables, I guarantee 14 of those are probably not a problem, and only one of them is.
Well, that's a reasonable general rule, is that if you think about scaling out your entire application, say to yourself, you know, if I had 10 times as much traffic or 10 times as much data, which are the bits that are going to break? And that's, you know, that's kind of our best key to guessing what's going to break next. I mean, we have stuff in Flickr that is really badly engineered, badly in the kind of scalable sense, that will just never be a problem because we'd have to be 10,000 times the size for it to be an issue. So we'll just never worry about that.
One of the things that we've been talking about at Dig internally recently, though, Cal, about that, is that, for instance, we have a certain part of our site that falls under that pretext. I won't name it, but the problem is when you get to be the size of like a Dig or a Flickr, if someone happens to find that shitty code and DOSes it, like there are parts of our code that like, if somebody found out about it, like, it would be a problem.
Dude!
But what I'm saying, though, like, so you need to make sure that you're paying attention to all of the bits of code, but you could, yeah.
You cut my three.
I'd say that's true for us, too. I mean, there's just parts that are a lot slower. But we've never had anyone find them, really.
I mean, a lot of the slowest parts of our app are in the administration functions that, you know, people who work on the site hit. There's a whole bunch of admin pages that if anyone hits, it actually cripples certain databases.
Yeah. Oh, no, we're totally in the same. There's a couple things if the admins do it. It's like the first thing when the sites go down, we literally go, all right, what were the admins doing? Like, who was doing what? Because, I mean, you take a lot of liberties on the admin, the back part of your site.
Any of the code paths that get exercised the least are, you know, are the more likely to fall into disrepair.
So speaking of all these tools, what are your main, like, you couldn't live without tools for monitoring your servers?
DF.
I am fully in support of Ganglia, ganglia.sourceforge.net, which is a fucking awesome way to graph lots of stuff across lots of servers. If you have more than one server, you should totally be using it. We use it to monitor and graph historical data on thousands of stats across tens of thousands of servers.
We use Munin for the graphing, Monit for on-box sort of restarts and monitoring, and then Nagios for the stuff that makes people's beepers go off.
Nagios is awesome.
No, Nagios sucks, but is there anything
the
better?
The interface sucks. The interface sucks, but the actual polling and whatnot is awesome.
Yeah.
We use all of those things.
Yeah, we use all three, too, so.
Yeah. MRTG and stuff, RRD, that kind of stuff.
We do a lot of custom graphing with RRD for stuff that doesn't fit well into Ganglia.
And weren't you talking about Parrot at FOA, Cal?
Parrot?
What's Parrot? What is the config thing that's written in Python that you were talking about that was like totally awesome and
Puppet. Puppet. Yeah, no, Puppet's awesome for configuration.
Yeah, we've actually just started using Munin fairly recently, and actually Barry from WordPress was totally helping out with it. It was totally really cool. Munin, M-U-N-I-N. And one of the things that's really, really awesome about Munin is that writing plugins for other things you might want to graph is trivial. So you can pretty much start graphing almost anything in like half an hour. So it's definitely worth checking out.
It's pretty much the same with Ganglia. Anything you can feed as a number to the command line, you can graph.
Yeah.
Cool. Another question?
Yeah, actually I have a slightly less technical question. Our site has just gotten a lot of growth in the community, and I'm wondering about community scaling because all of our old users are really smart and cool, and all of our new users are less smart and less cool. And like last night, there was like a little revolt on the site where like the old users were kind of really unhappy with everything. And I'm wondering, especially you, Kevin, I know you've dealt with some of that revolt stuff, and just what are methods to like help a community scale and, you know, keep the culture good?
Well, definitely give them the tools to moderate themselves, especially with the comment system. I mean, it was just brutal until we added the ability to bury comments and make it really easy and right in their face. Like, here is a big button. If you don't like this comment, you know, shove it down. Even though they see the comment, they still feel happy that I got it out of my face and I helped bury that comment. And then also, obviously, communicating with your audience. I mean, one of the things that we've learned, we've gotten better at, I think, in the last 6 months is, you know, having things like our town halls where we do live video cast to everyone. And we're actually going to be holding public town halls where people can come in and ask questions, and we'll do it live and streaming out on the web. So as much as we can get that back and forth conversation going between the audience and our site, the more you can do that, the better. How about you guys? You have some community stuff.
Yeah, I think to give people lots of options. I mean, a lot of times we'll come in and try to add features for new users or things that try to stop spam or things like that, and it'll affect other people as well. So we just try to give as many controls as possible. There's a few features we're about to roll out in the next couple of weeks, and I'm thinking a lot about the UI and how to like turn it off, because we're going to default it on, but a lot of people may not like it. So we have to make it really, really easy for people to kind of turn it off. So definitely think a lot about giving as much, as much control as possible. So
I think the number one thing, and actually one of the reasons I'm really excited about what Dig is going, is its personalization. Because the communities don't scale, to be honest. I mean, it's just not natural as humans. It doesn't work past a certain point. So allowing people to segregate themselves, have groups like Flickr has, have areas where they can only see the things they care about and not the stuff they don't, make it as easy as possible for them.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. I was just curious, do you ever run into issues where your local development copy gets too far away from your production copy, where you have issues developing locally? For any of you?
There's these things in SVN called branches. Well, I highly recommend you check them out. Branch all the time.
Branches are dangerous.
Branches are evil.
Let's
take a vote. All those in favor of branches on the panel, raise their hand. Fuck.
We don't do them yet.
all those not
Dick
in favor.
Dick had two votes, though.
Yeah, one of the things that that I've been trying to move more towards is iterative development. So one of the things we recently had this on the Dig profiles that touched, I think that entire project was probably 30 or 40,000 lines of code, and it literally touched every single file on the entire site. There's just certain times when you can't do that. One of the things that we do at Dig, our release process is basically we develop on trunk, sometimes branches, sorry Cal, and then when it becomes apparent that we're getting ready to freeze our code, we create a branch with a version number, like version 8.0 or whatever. And then what happens is you have that snapshot of your next release, and then we tag that and then push just the tags. So if something happens where, like, with profiles, when we were way, way, way ahead and, like, out ahead of what, was on production, I could still go back to the 8.0 trunk or the 8.0 branch and fix bugs there and then push from there.
How often do you release a Dig?
Twice a month.
No, we're on a 4 week, 3 to 4 weeks.
We're going to twice a month.
Yeah, we're going. Well, to be honest, we do pushes at Dig anywhere between once a day and 45 times a day. So it all depends. You know, like we recently had some very errant, bizarre 404 problem in our API, and I think Steve pushed probably 50 or 60 pushes that day just for logging and, you know, and like analysts. And
yeah, stuff. I remember. I mean, we try and push fairly frequently, and I about a year ago I actually met the guy who's like, I think his job title is like senior scientist or something for eBay. So I mean, we all think we have big platforms, but he's got a fucking big platform, and I was amazed. They push like 3-4 times a week for eBay, which is like really, really, really big. And so, you know, and he was like, yeah, he's like, just keep pushing it and be able to roll back.
I think the key, though, when you do that is that you need to have that snapshot when you push. So copy over to, you know, your point release tag and then push, or however you end up doing that. I mean, you know, but when you get ready to push, always create a branch. And then, you know, if a huge bug comes up, you can fix it in the branch and push from the branch as opposed to trunk.
And watch.
We break things down as much as possible. So a lot of it's more of a human issue than a code or technical issue about how many times you push or anything like that. If you can break down the problem to the smallest pieces and then ship those and iterate them frequently, it's so much easier because you find the bugs as you go and you fix them as you go. So you're building on a stronger base. The most pain we were ever in was we don't sync with local copies. We sync with WordPress.org. Which is, you know, sometimes daily with WordPress.com, and sometimes it's a month or two out of sync, just depending on what's going on. And the most pain we've ever had and most trouble for our users was when we waited like a month and we actually did a branch, and we would never do it again. It was our single branch.
That's really interesting. Actually, what I meant to ask, I guess, is...
oh, man.
It is when you have things that you can't do in local development... for whatever reason, like that requires scaling things that you do in production but can't do on your local copy.
So we don't actually have local development copies at Flickr. We have a couple of central development copies that run out of boxes in the colo. There's too many moving parts to run development environments. There's too many components you need. I mean, we often talk and argue that we should maybe support local development copies, but we'd have to have so much stuff just done just so that it works on a local machine that it's not worth it.
We're the same way. It's all we have dev servers, so I mean nothing matters until you push to the dev server.
Yeah, we're the same way. We have, I mean, if you think about the moving parts on Dig, we have, you know, a bunch of database servers. So you need to, in order to properly test the code that does, for instance, you know, send write traffic here, send read traffic here, you need two databases. So you need to have two running copies of MySQL. You need to have a couple memcache so you can test to make sure memcache falls over, which that's pretty easy to do locally. We use MogileFS for file storage. Mogile, I think, requires at least two or three boxes to get up and running, so you need to somehow figure out how to get a couple different, you know. Mogile is MogileFS. It's a Dango product.
It's an anagram of Oh My God Files. Yeah, that's so fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Another thing I'd recommend is instead of having just dev and straight production, having like in between. And what we do is we have a beta group, which has like 1,000 users, 1,200 users in it. And if you join that group, you will then see kind of the cutting edge features in production. But whenever we deploy something, we know we're only deploying it to 1,200 people. So also if it affects load, like if it's rolling some new feature we think may incur a lot of load, doing it to 1,200 people will let us know if anything's severely broken right away. But you're actually testing in a live environment, just a very small audience. And those people have opted into seeing those leading edge features.
We
so
also
that's kind
have
of a nice in between of...
Yeah, we have a staging environment as well, which is an exact, basically slimmed down replica of our live environment. So our dev is constantly broken in one way or another, you know, as we're developing on it, and then staging is a little bit more pristine. We don't do anything actually like what Garrett's describing, but many, many, many people do that. Yahoo buckets traffic, Google does, Amazon does as well. So it's pretty common.
We do that for some releases, and we definitely do have multiple staging environments as well between development and production.
Thanks.
Hey guys, I have a quick question about international scaling. Like, what happens all of a sudden if your site is really popular in Europe or Asia, and you know you still have to serve your U.S. customers? I guess you could say
multiple data centers.
Okay,
there's a panel next at 5 that you should go to because it's a guy from Flickr talking about internationalization. Talking about the internationalization of Flickr. Blah, 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 blah. You should totally go see that. So, I mean, we host all of our data in the U.S. for Flickr, but we have a lot of worldwide users. So just we cache out around the world.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's 2/3 of our traffic is international, but the latency of the actual dynamic page load, it's just so much easier to have it all be in the U.S. for replication for, you know, laws. The legal situation in the U.S. is actually better than other places. And then use a CDN. The one I usually recommend is Panther. We've used Akamai, like 20 others, but Panther is really cheap. They charge you only for what they use. There's no contracts, and you basically get like 80% of what Akamai does. And where international users really notice it is for not the one dynamic page load, the PHP thing. It's for the 20 CSS files and JavaScript files and everything else, because they're getting maybe 100 millisecond hit for each one of those. So that back and forth is where they feel it, and a CDN can fix all that.
Yeah. And even just using a CDN for just those files and serving the main page from the US gives you a big win.
That's what we do, yeah.
Howdy. So question about caching. Everybody agrees that, you know, caching's the bomb, right? But what exactly do we mean by that? Because you can kind of cache at every level throughout the infrastructure.
And
so
probably
what would you
should.
Say kind of the top three? I mean, I know Cal will say memcached, but in general, you know, what are
memcached.
The three best
everyone
places
would, yeah.
to implement caching first, I guess?
Well, I mean, the most important one at Flickr is Squid for our file serving. So Flickr serves quite a lot of photos. So, like, I pulled a stat yesterday morning. Yesterday morning, we were serving 32,000 photos a second. And we kind of sustain that rate most of the time. So we serve a lot of photos. So caching of photos is the most important thing for us. We could turn off our Memcache cluster, and the site would still work. It would be a little bit sluggish. It wouldn't work on a Monday morning. But Squid is the most important portion. So, I mean, Squid is good if you have a large, so it's for file caching. If you have a large data set where you need to keep a lot of stuff on disk, if it's all in memory, then take a look at Varnish, which is badly documented but kind of awesome.
We use Varnish, yeah.
Varnish isn't very good if you have a really large set of files on disk because it's much lower.
So we're using it with this now. The new version is pretty good.
Serious?
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a little bit of benchmarking. Oh, really?
Oh, really?
I feel a fight coming on. I would say that there's the two most important caching things are your front end kind of what I call output caching, which is what Squid does, Netscaler does, and a few other things, and then Memcache. And the caching strategy with Memcache that we're taking, and I know Cal takes as well, is that you stuff it into cache. A lot of people will be like, okay, well, I'm going to cache, and I'll let this expire in 5 minutes because that's how long I can withstand this data being dirty. What we actually do is we cache forever, and then we explicitly dirty it. So, like, user information, how often do people actually change their user data on certain things, like their email and other things? It's about once every, I don't know, probably 45 days. Mm-hmm. So we cache the user object permanently, and then when you go and actually touch something, we then expire it.
Us, we did that, and that's sort of the same process we have for our underlying things, like object caches. But some of our biggest wins have been on output caches, so like the entire page. And when you think about it, even if you're only caching for a single second, if you're getting a page that's getting dug or getting, you know, the front page of Yahoo, which happened to us, you know, if you're caching for 1 second, now you're down from 20 million pages a day to like 86,400, right? So that has a huge effect, and it can be a dirty cache. You just regenerate it every second, and that can be super, super, super effective. We can generate, we actually call it hypercache, but something else is called that, but we're going to release it, and those pages generate in 5 to 10 milliseconds, so we can serve those all day long.
So we do something fairly similar to that. We don't cache the final output of the page because we have so much on-page customization. Mm-hmm. But we do cache, most of our caching is simple object level, so like a photo data or a user data. But we do certain kinds of page level caching for things where non-logged in users are viewing, where we can tolerate stale data for up to a minute. So if you hit somebody's main photo stream page and you're not logged in, you'll be getting a view from a minute ago, and that saves us an awful lot of database reads.
I think we only do it for not logged in users.
Yeah, I think sort of one thing that a little underlying theme here too is that with a dirty cache, it's worthwhile to maybe talk to your users or, you know, examine whatever patterns you have and ask yourself the question, how long can I get away with a dirty cache where it's not going to piss anybody off? I was asking Joe about some of the stuff they do for search at Dig, and he was like, yeah, the way it works, some stuff doesn't get indexed for like half an hour, but that's okay. Like, it doesn't piss the users off, so that's fine. Because, you know, when I was thinking of the problem, like, you know, God, how do I index in real time? And then I was like, oh, well, shit, maybe I don't have to index in real time. If it's 10 minutes later, no one cares. So, you know, that's a really useful metric to go after when you're looking at a dirty cache situation.
Yeah, it depends on how dynamic data source is and how quickly you're going to see it. If it's in the background, like search, it won't matter as much. So.
This brings up a really good point. It's something that I like to call near-time processing. If you're not using a queuing system of some sort, I would definitely check out, Twitter's is called Starling. There's Gearman. We use Gearman personally, and a few others out there. So basically, you have to look at a lot of things at what we look at the site and we say, what don't we have to do right now? Certain things that we don't have to do right now, like update your Facebook profile when you dig, if you have the Facebook app installed, that you don't care. Like, that can happen 5 minutes from now. So we stuff that into a queue, and, you know, 5 minutes later it gets updated, whatever, that's fine. Even digging, we actually have a small queue for that, and we actually cache that you've dug it. So it always looks like you've dug it, but in reality that it doesn't hit the database for probably another 15 seconds after you've actually done it. So you just need to look at places where you don't need to worry about that.
What do you guys use? Because we don't use a queuing system, I'm curious. You mentioned Gearman.
For what now?
For a queuing system. You mentioned Gearman, Starling.
We use Gearman, okay. Personally. So
it's one of Blaine's terms is that nearly everybody who builds something in scale nearly always ends up building a ghetto queue in MySQL. We have a ghetto queue.
So true.
Yeah, so true. Does it run on cron too? Because that's like super ghetto. Cron plus MySQL.
Yeah.
Yes. That's like housing projects. That's way past ghetto.
It's kind of awesome though, because I mean we already scaled out our database and we already have cron, you know, so it just works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Next question.
So APIs are really fun, and I've dabbled with things like the Dig API. I created a database of the most buried comments, which is kind of interesting, and which is, you know, not always just spam. It's alternate, you know, opinions and stuff. But everyone's throwing an API out there, and I'm also going to be throwing out an API. And I'm just wondering if there were any surprises. Did you have to scale it differently than just what you had out there? Just because you need. There's a different demand, and also if you're not going to throttle the users, they could just start hitting your database like crazy.
Our API is actually just a different presentation of the exact data. So both the website, when you say, I want to look at this story, if you do that through the API or the website, it hits the exact same cache object. So the infrastructure behind both of those is exactly the same. The only difference is one of them basically uses API template, and the other one uses, you know, something else. So it uses an HTML template.
On the other hand, there's something about providing an API which says to people, yes, we would like you to scrape all of our data as fast as you can. So we have a whole bunch of photos, and a lot of people think maybe it would be a good idea if I copied the metadata for a billion of them in an hour. People don't tend to be that retarded with regular web pages, but there's something about APIs that brings out the idiots. So, I mean, like... If you're at scale, you don't want to be doing an API without, and this is a mistake we made, was you need some kind of throttling in there early on. So Flickr, I won't give away all the secrets, but we definitely throttle anyone who's doing more than 100 QPS sustained for an hour, because what the fuck are you doing? And it's nearly always research students. Students say, oh, I didn't realize that I couldn't do that many queries. I didn't realize I couldn't spin up 100 EC2 instances to suck all your data out so I can do some dumb project.
Yeah. I would do the same thing. The same thing we said for web pages, though. Like, we spent a lot of time when we launched the Atom API for WordPress and WordPress.com. We were kind of worried about it because it used different database stuff. And it ends up that there's no Atom client, so no one uses it. They all use the other APIs. So for those sorts of things, I mean, get it out there first and then figure out their throttling and all that later.
So this is slightly different. I want to go back to your question about branching and builds and stuff. So I'm interested in what kind of software engineering practices you use, test-driven development, and how well it works in these environments, right? Because it works really well in a small.
I've recently started doing a lot more unit testing, and I'm actually requiring that, especially on basically every object you create or function. I'm requiring that you have a unit test, and that's helping immensely with our regression testing.
I don't want to work at Dig.
Ouch.
I'll leave you guys to that.
So our development process is track, SVN. I described how we branch and how we tag. We only push from tags. We have our main code. We also have some pair packages that we have created internally. Those are in a separate process where we push those using pairs distribution channel. More and more, we're doing a lot of unit testing using PHPT and PHP unit, and that's helping find a lot of bugs, and it's helping keep that regression check up, because there's a lot of code that, you know, I wrote code at Dig a year ago that nobody has touched since then. God, I hope it still works, you know, and that's where unit tests really
help. That could be a good thing, you know?
Yes, no, I mean, that's obviously the point, right? You want to create code that you don't ever touch again, but
you want to avoid
as part of that,
breaking it in the
people accidentally breaking it, or, you know, like this function A uses function B, function A hasn't changed in 6 months, function B changed 10 minutes ago, function A and B are both broke now, unit tests will catch that. So, unit tests, I can't stress enough like how awesome unit tests are, even though Cal hates them.
If you have the discipline to do them.
Yeah. So Cal, you're moving to Microsoft technology soon, right?
Yeah. Oh. So at the moment, we're putting a lot of work into porting Flickr over to .NET and SQL Server. Seriously. I know the open source stuff is trendy, but it just doesn't cut it in the real world.
Yeah, we've got one more question.
Y'all have thrown out a lot of different tools to help scale your systems. Some of them I've used, like LVS, others I haven't, like MogulFS. Is there a nice place that we can find how to configure these utilities or how to make them work together, which ones work together, which ones don't?
Google?
Not really. I think
God, I wish.
There's yeah, one blog out there called Highly Scalable Websites or something.
Oh, yeah. High Scalability.
I don't know, but they discuss kind of...
Yeah, High Scalability.
High Scalability, yeah. So they have a blog out there that they basically interview guys like us and say, what are you using and how are you using it? But I can't stress enough how I would say 90% of what I've learned and how I've figured things out and how I fix things have been completely trial and error. I can't tell you how many times I've epically blown up sites on just an amazing scale. So, and that's really, that's one of the drawbacks of open source, right? There's not one major solution. Like Microsoft is this huge solution provider that has A to Z. With open source, it's a lot of trial and error, a lot of Googling, and a lot of mailing lists. And
well, aside from conferences like this where you guys talk, do any of you release configurations or types of this type of information?
The Wikipedia does, I mentioned earlier. They release all their configuration
files. I would also look at Debian-administration.org. There's a site, and it's not specific to any given technology, but I found a lot of useful how-tos on it. So.
Great. Ooh,
thanks,
everybody.
There's a pretty good book.
Sorry.
Finish up. Scalable Internet Architectures by Theo Schlossnagel. That's a really good book to read.
Yeah, I'd recommend it as well.
It's cool. Pretty We're all out of time.
Thanks,
everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.